Bradshaw into Wingate. Wingate's going to dribble it a couple of times and throws it in the hands of Cousinard. Threw it away. Cousinard to Ryan Martin for the dunk. The Shockers are going to the Sweet 16. It's all over. The Shockers up 7. 3 seconds. 2. Jumper by Smith is no good. Wichita State to the Sweet 16.
Hello, this is Paul Solentrop of Wichita State University Strategic Communications. We'd like to welcome you to a special edition of the Roundhouse Podcast. We're going to take a look back at the 2006 Missouri Valley Conference men's basketball season with some special guests. The Missouri Valley Conference enjoyed great basketball success dating back to the 1940s and into the mid-1980s before changes in conference membership changed the dynamics. It slipped in the 1990s outside of Tulsa's two Sweet 16s, and Tulsa departed the Missouri Valley Conference for the Western Athletic Conference in 1996. But things started to change in 1999 when three teams made the NCAA tournament, and Missouri State advanced to the Sweet 16 with wins over Wisconsin and Tennessee. The Valley earned an at-large bid in the next five seasons, and then earned two in 2005 to give it three teams total in the NCAA tournament. That set the stage for 05-06, a season in which consistent MVC powers Creighton and Southern Illinois kept rolling. Missouri State stayed in the upper division. Wichita State and Northern Iowa continued their improvements, and Bradley surprised with a bounce back. Wichita State, coached by Mark Turgeon, had been to the NIT in 2003 and 2004 to start its rebuild. In 2005, the Shockers felt they were ready to make the final step and get back to the NCAA tournament, but a frustrating fade late in the season sent them back to the NIT. The Shockers entered 05-06 picked fifth in the Missouri Valley Conference after the departure of seniors Jamar Howard, Randy Burns, and Rob Campman, the group that had lifted the Shockers out of their previous struggles. In 06, the Shockers won their first MVC title since 1983, and they returned to the NCAA tournament for the first time since 1988. MVC Player of the Year Paul Miller had a fabulous senior season. He had a balanced team around him, featuring Kyle Wilson, P.J. Cousinard, Ryan Martin, Matt Breyer, and Sean O'Geary, and that group carried the Shockers back into Marsh's spotlight. That season served as a landmark for the MVC and for college basketball, opening an era in which we saw George Mason, Butler, VCU, and Wichita State advance to the Final Four. 2005-06, the season the Missouri Valley Conference beat the system and helped change college basketball. Four teams in the NCAA tournament, two in the Sweet 16. The Valley finished number 6 in the RPI, number 7 in Ken Pomeroy's rankings. Bradley's Patrick O'Brien was a lottery draft pick. The 5th and 6th seeds in the Missouri Valley Conference tournament earned at-large bids. And Doug Elgin got the last laugh on Billy Packer.
This group does what others before them could not do and did what it had to do, and that is win a tournament championship. The final seconds of Southern's Missouri Valley Conference tournament championship and a spot in the NCAAs. Clemens hurls the ball to the sky. The Saluki fans rush the floor, and Southern wins it 59-46.
If you'd asked me, Art, in October after media day, Coach, would you take a 20 RPI and second in the league second toughest schedule in the league and won 8 out of your last 10, would you take that right now? And as well as I do, we'd say yes.
We have three people here who covered the Missouri Valley Conference that season to discuss 2005-2006. We have Paul Klee. He covered Saluki basketball for 05 and 06 for the Southern in Carbondale. Paul is now a sports columnist for the Gazette based in Denver. Lyndall Scranton covered Missouri State basketball from 1987 to 2015 for the Springfield News Leaders. He is now the PR director for Lucas Oil Speedway in Wheatland, Missouri, and also co-host of the Tailgate Guys Barbecue Show podcast. And we have Dave Reynolds. He's covered Bradley since 1990 for the Peoria Journal Star. Let's get into it first with just some rapid fire, some quick memories from that 05-06 season. Paul Klee, we'll let you get us led off.
Right on. Well, I appreciate you doing this, Paul, because it put me down a rabbit hole on YouTube for the last couple of days watching some seriously good ball. Quick memories, I think mine is probably looking back at the coaching. And not just the coaches themselves, but how accessible everybody was. If you needed something, you call Greg McDermott and he'd probably answer his phone, or you'd call Porter Mosier and he'd answer his phone. With SIU specifically, I didn't realize this till the other day, but I want to say they had 9 guys from that specific era that turned into head coaches. That's wild. It was obviously after Bruce, and then you had Paint, you had Chris Lowry, you had Brad Korn, Rodney Watson, Anthony Stewart, Kyle Smith, Peters, Lance Irvin, and Brian Mullins. That's pretty amazing to me that one era can produce that many head coaches. And then, of course, I think we'll all probably say the same thing, that every night was an event. It didn't matter where you were playing. If it was one of those top 6 teams, it was going to be a really, really good game. So those are probably my best memories from that time. The most fun I've ever had doing this job was that valley. It really was.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to describe it. That was a lot of emotion during that season. Dave Reynolds, what sticks out, a memory or two from the Bradley Braves that season?
Well, first of all, I want to mention 15 years later, I'm the only one on the panel still doing the same thing as I did back then. So whatever that's worth. But it's been a good ride with Bradley. And that year in particular stands out, obviously, for what they accomplished, reaching the Sweet 16. But it was a very rocky road to get to the tournament. It was a team that played very well at times and very poorly at times. And there were 2 key players that eventually, you know, became very prominent later in the season, Patrick O'Brien and Will Franklin. They missed the entire non-conference season because of ineligibility. And that kind of happened right at the last minute before the opener. It kind of led to a rough start. They were 8-6 and 2-4 in the league. And Jim Les was so frustrated. It was the Wichita State game in Peoria, Paul, that you probably remember. Wichita won handily that night, and it did not go over well in the Bradley locker room. Jim Les decided he was throwing the starting lineup open to whoever played the hardest in practice the next 2 days. And Marcellus Somerville was out, and J.J. Twy, who was at that point a deep reserve on the team, who'd been highly touted but just hadn't realized his potential, he earned a starting spot. JJ didn't score much, but he was kind of the catalyst that got that team going that year. He was, you know, kind of the glue guy. You know, he played unselfishly, played tough defensively, and is just exactly what they needed. They finished the season from there on 14-5. And it also kind of enabled them to bring Lawrence Wright off the bench, where he was more effective once Somerville got back in the lineup. So those are kind of my thoughts on that team. It was a team that started poorly, but boy, did they come on strong.
Lindell, Missouri State, give us a memory or two.
Well, I just remember the late that season, just the wide range of emotions that team went through. The final night of the regular season in Hammond Student Center before a packed house, beating Creighton and taking a 5-game winning streak into the Valley Tournament. And everyone thought that this team was probably a cinch to get into the NCAA Tournament because of the resume that it had had. And then 6 days later, maybe the team thought they were a cinch, and they laid an egg in the quarterfinals against Northern Iowa and lost 57-42 in just a dreadful performance. And, of course, then 9 days later, Selection Sunday comes around, and I always remember being in Barry Hinson's basement at the team watch party and just the unbelievable silence that fell when the bracket reveal was finished and the Bears were left out.
Yeah, Lindell is here to detail the sad, painful story of the Bears from that season, not making the NCAA tournament despite a fabulous RPI. Mine, I will go with the top 2 memories that come to my mind. Valentine's Day, when everything kind of changed, Matt Breyer made a shot to beat Creighton in overtime, and other teams lost, and that was kind of Wichita State's moment to take over the Valley race. And then when Wichita State beat Tennessee to advance to the Sweet 16, and I remember typing the words 2 wins away from the Final 4, and those were not words that I really ever anticipated typing when covering Wichita State. Let's talk a little bit about how the Valley got here, because it was kind of a slow build. The 90s were not great. Things started to change a little bit with Danny Moore and the Bears in 99, and then the Valley kept building, had a really good 04-05 with three teams in the NCAA tournament, and then it really pops with four in 05-06. And Dave, let's talk about Bradley a little bit, because they were kind of the big surprise. They were 13-15 the year before. What kind of got Bradley to join this upper division group?
Yeah, and in fact, this 05-06 was Jim Les's fourth season as head coach, and he hadn't done much to that point. He was kind of on the hot seat, and he made a couple of key moves that year that really triggered that success. And the first one, he had an assistant coach. At the time, he was a legendary local high school coach named Chuck Bisher, and he had just coached his Peoria High team to two back-to-back state championships, led by future NBA player Sean Livingston. But Brisher's calling card was his hard-nosed defense that he taught very well, and it hadn't really been demanding of the Bradley teams under Les. He was more of an offensive coach, and Brisher came in and installed that defense, and that was once they really dedicated to it. That was really the thing that got that team going. They added a couple of junior college transfers. I mentioned Will Franklin before. Once they found out what they had with him, he was a very good player, added even more quickness to an already quick backcourt. And then Zach Andrews, a big guy who gave them the inside depth they needed to back up Patrick O'Brien at center. And those are kind of the main things that kind of got this team going. As I mentioned, it still took them a while to hit their stride. But once they did, those were the factors that really stand out to me.
Paul, Southern Illinois had been a real consistent Valley power through most of the early part of that decade. This was Chris Lowry's now second season. They lost Darren Brooks and Stetson Harrison. What was kind of the feel around that program heading into this season?
It was, I'd call it probably a bridge year almost. And it started out in Alaska. God, goodness gracious, that godforsaken tournament. It you'd walk outside, it's 3 o'clock and it's dark, and they lose to a D2 team. They lose to Alaska Anchorage up there in front of about 36 people. And they put it together, they got it all together, they won a bunch of games in the non-conference, beat some good teams, and then they get to the Valley and it's just – they're having a tough time. You know, they're not getting into the NCAA tournament if they don't win Arch Madness. And it is a relatively young Saluki team. I think Jamal Tatum's a junior. He's the oldest guy. Randall Falker, who was he was the MVP of the Arch Madness in St. Louis. He has 17-16 in the championship game. Tony Young's a sophomore. Brian Mullins, the freshman. But they were tough, man. They were really tough. They were difficult to deal with no matter how good their offense was that night, because they just beat the heck out of you. They were extremely physical. They beat Bradley in the championship game in St. Louis. I think they score 55 points. They beat Northern Iowa in the semis. They score 55 or 53 points in overtime, and that's just kind of how they won games. It was really a Saluki team that laid the groundwork for the next year when you go to the Sweet 16, a really good Saluki team that actually you beat Kansas and you might go to the Final Four. So a joy to cover, just a lot of fun personalities. Randall was an interesting guy. Jamal Tatum, Tony Young was different. You know, he was a tough guy. He wasn't a highly regarded recruit, but you didn't want him guarding you. And just a lot of fun to cover. Chris Lowry was a joy to cover. He was terrific. Rodney Watson was there, and Brad Korn and these guys, great to cover. But they weren't the team that they were going to become quite yet. And that Valley tournament was as good as it gets. I mean, you guys remember how packed that place was. and SIU and Bradley in a championship game that I'll never forget. It was terrific, and they barely cracked 100 between the two of them. And so, yeah, that's what I remember about that Saluki team.
There was a lot of defense played in the conference that year for sure. Lindell and Dave, you would have covered the Valley through the 90s and through the early part of that decade. Was there a feel that, you know, that the conference, that the schools were figuring things out and they were, you know, getting on a better path and around this time?
Well, yeah, I'll jump in. The key to Bradley was when Jim Molinari became head coach, and he brought with him, you know, his special brand of man-to-man defense. And I think that that was, you know, a huge factor in where the Valley was going, because before that, you know, it was not a real strong defensive league, and Mo kind of brought that in and started winning games with it. And I think other programs bought into it. Obviously Tulsa was strong during that period, but everybody else was pretty, Wichita, Creighton, you know, Bradley, they were all pretty down. Bradley got it going in the mid 90s, but yeah, I think that the defense that Mo brought was a big part of it.
Yeah, you know, the 90s were really kind of a down decade for the Valley. With 99 came along, 98, 99, and they did get three teams in the tournament, Missouri State, Creighton, and Evansville. But that was kind of an outlier. I don't think that happened again for a few years. And then Southern came along when Bruce Weber kind of kicked things into gear, and they were kind of the gold standard along with Creighton in the early 2000s. I think the other teams in the league saw what those two were doing and really piggybacked off style of play and knew that you had to have some tough guys and play some really rugged defense. Another thing that I thought happened in the early 2000s to mid-2000s was the facilities upgrades you saw. You know, I think that's when Creighton opened its new arena. Wichita State had a renovation. Northern Iowa was still in the Uni Dome, I think, in 05, 06, but it was soon to move into the McLeod Center. So, and then the old arenas were still great places to watch games, you know, hold the old Hammond Student Center. Peoria's Civic Arena was always a great place to watch a game. So there was just a lot of energy in the league that energy just got better and better as the teams got better in the mid-2000s.
One of the big themes of this season, you know, was the non-conference scheduling and how the Valley had, I think, cracked the code and beaten the RPI was, you know, those were the phrases that got turned around. So let's talk about the non-conference scheduling, and I'll throw out a few, a little bit of background. I think Northern Iowa was the big winner non-conference. They beat Iowa and they beat LSU, and those were in the days when they got Iowa and Iowa State at home, so that was certainly helpful. The Valley went 80-34 in non-conference play, still one of its best marks. It was 12-12 versus what we now call Power 5 schools. Indiana State beat Indiana in Terre Haute. Purdue went to Roberts Stadium and lost to Evansville. Those are the kind of things that have really changed. How did the non-conference scheduling really play into this season, and how much have we seen that change over the years where now a lot of those things don't happen? Paul, go ahead and take that one.
Yeah, this is an awesome topic because I think scheduling was everything. It was everything for that league, and it was Doug. You know, it was Doug Elgin that was behind it. Cracking the code was, it came off as kind of had negative connotations. It came from the big boys, right? You know, they said they cracked the code and they fixed it and all this, but it was just smart is what they did at that time. You actually had and didn't finish their schedule. They still needed two games, and CeeLo was pissed. He couldn't get anybody to play him. They're at a point where they were 66-3 at home over the previous 5 or 6 years, and you know the big guys, they wouldn't come into the Saluki Dome and play those guys. So their priority was to have 15 games. I looked this up on the Southern's website from a story in 2005. And I remember this from Doug. He said it used to be that buy games would cost you $35,000 to $45,000. Now in 2005, nobody would go to Carbondale for less than 60. Well, SIU couldn't afford that. They're budgeted up to about $50,000. So money was a problem. I guess there's a reason why SIU and SEMO, they played 111 times up to that point. They were close, they were cheap, and they were agreeable to playing each other. So I think the bracket buster came along and it helped things. There was a movement that said the Valley had gotten too big for the bracket buster, but that just wasn't the case. You got to find somebody to play you. And I think it was Porter Mosier. It may have come up with this. I'm not positive, but to save a road game until August, to leave one open. And that's how they ended up getting that home and home with Cincinnati that year or the next year, one of the two. They saved a road game, and so you wait for a power conference team to say, we need a home game, and then you got them. You know, you get them in a home and home with Cincinnati, and that was the only way you could get it. But scheduling was 100% the biggest part, I think, of how the Valley was able to do what it did.
Yeah, I never understood the cracking the code comment from the standpoint. You still had to win games. Ultimately, that what was it about. Dave and Lindell, and you would remember this, being on the conference call every week, and there would, you know, usually be someone from the New York Times or the Chicago Tribune at that point, just trying to figure it out. What do you remember about, you know, how the national media was kind of all of a sudden looking at the Valley with some curiosity at that time?
Yeah, I think people around the country were looking at the RPI ratings every week and wondering how this mid-major conference was able to have five teams in the top 40 or whatever the number was. And it was just simply they were scheduling smartly, as, you know, kind of guided by Doug Elgin, avoiding those teams in the 300s, you know, in the RPIs that had were going to have losing records, schedule people that were going to be 500 or better in their conferences, but ultimately you do have to beat them, which the Valley did that year, beat them regularly, and that's how they pulled that off. And, you know, Missouri State was 7-1 in non-conference. It wasn't a great non-conference schedule, but they didn't have any, you know, real duds on there that would drag you down. And that was a big key. They did fumble. Their one loss in non-conference that year was at Arkansas, a four-point loss in one of those bye games, you know, where you go get paid $90,000 at the time and probably are expected to take your beating. But if they win that game, and I remember thinking at the time, you know, this is their best chance to have a non-conference stamp of approval on the resume, and they've kind of let that one get away. And at the time, I thought, well, this may come back to haunt them in March. And sure enough, I think it did.
I think that, Lindell, that was that game that I think Blake Ahern dunked all over Arkansas, didn't he?
Oh, yeah, yeah. He had a dunk, and everybody was just – their mouths were open, you know, about how this guy do that. But, yeah, it was a fun night down there, big crowd. Arkansas was still drawing big crowds at that time, you know.
The other thing I think helped with the RPI was the other four schools in the Valley were pretty decent. Nobody was really bad. I don't have the numbers in front of me of what their RPIs were, but those bottom four, if I remember correctly, may have had winning records in non-conference season as well. And so you weren't getting dragged down by playing your own conference teams at all.
Right. Yeah, that's a great point. There were, I think, six or seven teams in the top 50, but then there was nobody below about 190 or 200, so you didn't have those real drags. And here's the great example, and I had kind of forgotten about this, but Indiana State was 8-0. They had beaten Indiana, which was ranked 18th at the time. They'd beaten Butler, which went on to the NIT. And then David Moss got hurt, and he missed most of January. So I think they lost 10 games in a row. So you were able to kind of feed off that good Indiana State performance. And then David Moss comes back in February, and they won some big games with him in the lineup. So that was kind of a random occurrence that really helped everybody else. Bracket Buster was a big weekend with the Valley doing so well. And another good example, I think, of Doug Elgin's leadership of getting coaches and administrators on board. How much did Bracket Buster help the Valley that season? Lindell, you've kind of got, again, the sad, painful story, but Missouri State won and ultimately didn't end up helping them as much.
Yeah, you know, Bracket Buster, at its peak, was a brilliant idea. I remember I was traveling with the Bears that year, and they went to Wisconsin, Milwaukee, or as Barry Hinson called them, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. That's what he referred to them as. But they were a really good non-conference opponent, and ultimately would go to the NCAA tournament themselves, I think.
And beat OU.
Yeah, exactly.
Beat Oklahoma.
But the Bears beat them at Milwaukee on a Saturday morning, 11 a.m. tip-off. And I think everyone thought that was going to be a win that might put them over the top. And just a side note, the way the Valley kind of the camaraderie that you had in the league at that time, the Bears had a layover at O'Hare in Chicago coming back from Milwaukee. And the Shockers were playing, was it George Mason? Uh-huh. Bracket Busters that late afternoon, early evening, and they were all the players were clustered around the TVs at the airport rooting for the Shockers, you know, hoping to just bring the Valley strength up even further. So at the time, you know, the Bracket Buster was really a great concept, and it's sad that it kind of faded away, because the mid-majors could honestly probably use a revival of that today.
Yeah, that's a story Barry Henson has told many times. I'll run through the Bracket Buster results from that day back in 06. Wichita State lost to George Mason, a great game at Koch Arena. Bradley beat Tennessee Tech, which didn't seem to hold much significance. Missouri State beat Milwaukee. Northern Iowa beat Bucknell to add another good non-conference win for the Panthers. Bucknell went on to beat Arkansas in the NCAA tournament. Creighton beat Fresno State, and Southern Illinois lost to Louisiana Tech. Conference season, just a crazy conference season.
That La Tech team, this is funny here. That was the Louisiana Tech team with Paul Millsap, and he now plays for the Nuggets here in Denver. And okay. I brought that game up to him 2 years ago, probably, and said, "Do you remember this game from February 15 years ago or whatever it was?" And he remembered it. I said, "What do you remember about that game at the Saluki Dome?" Said, "Physical." So that's about probably what it was. It was 54-51, and it was the first one of 50 wins.
Yeah, you saw a lot of defense and a lot of fouls, Paul, that season covering the Salukis. We get into the conference season. I think people are excited, and it kind of starts off in a great way. Bradley had a couple overtime games to start. It was a great defensive conference. I think that's what stands out. Five teams in the KenPom top 30 for defense, a little more average on offense. And maybe there are so many interesting things on this, but let's start with the Bears. Lindell, they got off to a kind of an uneven start, but then finished strong, I think, winning eight of their final nine entering the Valley Tournament. What happened with the Bears to get them to finish so strong?
You know, it seemed like Barry Henson's teams played better in the second half of the season for whatever reasons. And, they were 8-1 down the stretch that year. And the loss was, a two-pointer at SIU, where nobody won at that time. And they clicked really well. You know, they played their roles the way they needed to. Blake Ahern, I think, was the only guy who averaged in double figures, but you had five or six other guys who were averaging like between 8.5 and 9.9 points. So they just were a very balanced team. And this was, I think, year three. A lot of these guys were juniors from very, very ballyhooed recruiting class from 03-04. So they were just kind of hitting their stride and played really well down the stretch.
Bradley had that start with an OT win over Northern Iowa, an OT loss at WSU, and then they finished strong, as Dave talked about. Shockers couldn't beat Northern Iowa. Then they had a huge win, two overtime win against Southern Illinois at home. They had the buzzer beater versus Creighton, and then they really kind of took off from there. Southern Illinois struggled at the end of the season. Northern Iowa was really kind of in control. They were 9-2 at one point, had wins at Wichita State and had beaten Missouri State. Then they faded, lost four of their final five. Creighton at one point won 10 of 11, and then they lost two in a row and faded. And as we talked about, Missouri State was really hot entering the Valley Tournament. February 14th, that's the day everything kind of changed. What do we remember about that day? And maybe it was a bigger deal from Wichita State than it was the other one, but does Valentine's Day 06 resonate with you folks?
Well, I'll jump in on that one. Bradley played Evansville that night at home, and that was coming off the big loss to Wichita State. And so reconfigured lineup for the Braves, you know, a new attitude. Evansville came to town, and Bradley just, you know, took them apart. They won by 30, I think. And so that was a kind of a huge game for them to kind of get themselves righted and, you know, get going the right direction. But I'll turn it over to the other guys as far as what else happened.
Yeah, I don't recall exactly Missouri State purposes, but I just know that the Bears are winning close games and going into tough places and winning. You know, the Uni Dome was far from a great basketball arena, but the environment there was, you know, for anybody who covered a game there, it was a very strange place to play basketball. And a lot of times it was tough for teams to go in there and win. But the Bears won just a classic. It may have been that around that February 14th date.
Well, here's what happened on the 14th, and it really stood out for the Shockers. They beat Creighton, which was a huge deal. They had struggled with Creighton. Matt Breyer hit a shot in overtime. Indiana State beat Northern Iowa that night, or maybe that day, so that helped. And then Southern Illinois lost that day also. So entering February 14th, the race was kind of tight, and then I think the Shockers walked out of the arena that night, and they were in first place, maybe clear by a game, and ended up finishing strong. Let's get to the NCAA tournament. Lindell, okay, the Barry Hinson anecdote being in his basement, Paul Klee talked about accessibility. That's a really good example. And that just had to be just heartbreaking. Tell us about the NCAA selection show and how the Bears reacted.
Well, I think they all honestly thought they were going. And I remember I didn't have any confidence that they were going to get in, especially after Southern had won the championship game. As I thought they had to win to get in. That was, and I just didn't see any way the NCAA tournament was, or committee was going to put five Valley teams in. And I thought when Bradley and SIU made the finals, the Bears probably were going to be on the outside looking in. But the confidence level among the players and coaching staff and the other administrators who were there was very high. And over across town at Hammond Student Center, they were playing the women's tournament final that day. And the women, I think, were a 7 or an 8 seed going in and had a really poor season, but they ended up winning the tournament on their home court. So they're celebrating. And as I recall, Doug Elgin was over there at Hammond Student Center at the women's tournament. And that's where he watched the selection show. And I'm pretty sure that he was on the phone with Barry shortly after the men's selection show happened and trying to console him. But yeah, Barry was legitimately devastated. You know, a lot of times for those of you who know him, he kind of put on a show for folks, but it was legit. He was legitimately crushed over that deal, and there were a lot of tears shed that day.
Yeah, and to recap, Missouri State 21 in the RPI. I think they remain the highest or the best or the lowest RPI to not make it as an NCAA tournament team. UNI was 25, Shockers 27, Southern Illinois at 29, Bradley at 33, and then Creighton at 39. So there are people in the Valley who say should have had 5 and 6 wouldn't have been crazy. So they in 06, Missouri State was the first team in NCAA history better than 30 in the RPI, not rewarded with an NCAA bid. So we go to the NCAA tournament, and Bradley and Wichita State kind of take center stage. Dave, memories of the NCAA tournament?
Well, to piggyback on Lindell, the feeling around Peoria was not that Bradley was a shoe-in at all. I mean, it was that selection show, when Bradley's name popped up there, it was, you know, tremendous relief, surprise, whatever word you want to use. But, you know, just happy to see their name in the board. And then everybody said, oh, wait, we're playing Kansas. And Kansas at that time ranked 12th in the country, a young team, but they were just, you know, they just blew through the Big 12 tournament. They'd won, I don't know how many in a row, but it was a very tough match. Bradley was given a 13 seed, and that was just a surreal game. Bradley controlled the Jayhawks from opening tip. I think they only trailed briefly once. They led by 10 at halftime, held on to win by 4. Certainly one of the biggest upsets in school history. And then 2 days later, they beat Pittsburgh. Patrick O'Brien has 28 points on Aaron Gray, who went on to a long, journeyman career in the NBA. But the lasting image I have of that tournament up at Detroit was of the Bradley players running into the stands after the Pittsburgh game to slap hands with their fans. And those fans were just giddy. They had not sat down in their seats for the entire two games. So it was a big deal for Bradley. It'd been a long time since they'd been on that stage. And to go on to the Sweet 16, another formidable matchup. They played Memphis, which was ranked number 3 at that time. John Calipari was the coach. Bradley stayed with them the first half, ended up losing by 16, I believe. But it was a wonderful time for the Braves. Last time they won an NCAA tournament game, as a matter of fact, was in 05-06.
We had the Bradley, KU, and Pitt wins in the NCAA tournament. The Shockers were seeded 7th. They beat Seton Hall and then beat second-seeded Tennessee before losing to George Mason in Washington, D.C. Northern Iowa, 10 seed, lost to Georgetown. Southern Illinois, an 11 seed, lost to West Virginia. Interesting from Wichita State's run, Greg Marshall was coaching Winthrop, and they lost to Tennessee in the first round. They're on a last-second shot by Chris Lofton, and Marshall, of course, ended up at Wichita State two seasons later. Let's go. We've got about 3 minutes left. Let's go real quick. How'd the season change college basketball? Lasting impact. Paul Klee, go first.
Yeah, I think it was, I looked around the landscape this year, and you've got Dana Altman's at Creighton, or Dana Altman's at Oregon, you know, McDermott's at Creighton now. Porter had Loyola in the Final Four a couple years ago. Lowry goes to a Sweet 16 at SIU the next year. He helps Kansas State to an Elite Eight as an assistant, and Turges at Maryland, and that was probably a Final Four caliber team this season. So that's probably the lasting impression of all those coaches moving on to bigger and supposedly better things. I don't think it gets better than this Valley season, but you really had coaching that era in the Valley. I think that's what stuck with me, and probably why each game was a battle, because maybe the talent level was not an NBA talent level, but the coaching was as good as it gets, and it was a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah, and a lot of continuity. You had a guy like Tom Davis at Drake, definitely. Lindell, how'd this season change college basketball?
Well, that was kind of the peak for the non-Power 5 schools getting at-large bids. It still happened a little bit the next couple of years, but it's really declined since, and maybe a wake-up call for those money-grabbing Power Conference schools that we can't let these guys keep getting in our tournament. So you'll never see 8 mid-major teams in the NCAA tournament again.
Yeah, kind of blazed the trail. Gonzaga was already up and running at a real high level, but you know, we had George Mason in the Final Four that year, and then that led to VCU. I think the Colonial and the Valley really drafted.
Thank you for listening to the Roundhouse Podcast, courtesy of Wichita State University Strategic Communications. We appreciate your time. We encourage you to rate, review, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, such as on iTunes or Google Play. You can find more Roundhouse content at goshockers.com. Thank you for listening.